The Miami International Book Fair bills itself as the oldest in the country. This week, the fair celebrates its 25th anniversary. Mitchell Kaplan helped start the tradition. He owns the store Books and Books in Miami, and he's past president of the American Booksellers Association. He came into the studios of our member station, WLRN, and I asked what inspired him to start this fair.
The inspiration for it came out of the fact that Miami, back in 1982, wasn't really thought of much as a literary town. I had opened the bookshop just a couple years before, and I knew what people were reading, and I knew that what they were reading was as sophisticated as anywhere else in the country, and that Miami was getting sort of a bad rap.
So part of this was kind of a desire to contradict the stereotype of Miami as being maybe less cultured?
It was a bit of that. It was also an attempt to sort of develop some community pride. You know, in 1982, Miami was a pretty bleak place. Time magazine had an article with a headline, "The Miami Paradise Lost," with a big question mark. The downtown was kind of crumbling. South Beach wasn't as what we think of it today. So we decided that what we would do is we'd bring authors and we would bring publishers to show what books were being published. We thought what we would have to do in order to make it a region-wide fair is we'd want to celebrate the diversity that is and was Miami.
When you started this fair, there was no Amazon.com, there was no Borders Books and Music, there was no Kindle handheld electronic reading machine. How different is the world you're operating in today from the world that you were in then?
Well, those were the golden years, to be honest. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. The world was extremely different as a bookseller. Back then, probably over 50% of all books sold were sold through independent bookshops like mine. So it was extremely different.
I've got to say, you own the kind of store that has been going out of business all across the country, selling a technology that many people have stopped using, and yet you seem remarkably optimistic and sanguine and sort of at peace with the whole landscape.
Well, you know what it is? In some ways, we're selling the past. We're selling that sense of what used to be. And I think that's going to come back in all kinds of businesses. As people find themselves in economic hardship, they're going to want to go back to those things that bring them comfort. And I think that small, community-based businesses do that, and bookstores particularly.
You've been doing this for 25 years, and during that time, some of the world's greatest authors have come and spoken at the Miami International Book Fair. Is there one moment in particular that really sticks with you?
We've had, you know, everyone from Hunter Thompson to Joseph Heller, Jerzy Kosinski. We've had so many writers, Allen Ginsberg, writers who, you know, are giants who are no longer with us. Our first year, we had James Baldwin. But there was also a time that I remember and was early on, just as Garrison Keillor was at the height of his power.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of him.
With his radio program. And at the end, he led the entire auditorium in the singing of Amazing Grace. And it just, you know, for Miami at the time, which had just emerged from this kind of very difficult period, to see this auditorium filled with people all singing in a united voice was quite magical for me. That's something that I remember.
Mitchell Kaplan owns the store Books and Books in Miami. He's the co-founder of the Miami International Book Fair, celebrating its 25th anniversary this week. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
And here's a bestseller with an unlikely backstory, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It's the first book in a trilogy of thrillers written by a previously unknown Swedish journalist who died of a heart attack back in 2004. Without the author to help promote the book, the publisher has had to try some new strategies. And Martha Woodruff of member station WMRA reports those strategies are paying off.
The thrillers by the late Stieg Larsson had appeared on 5 European bestseller lists when Knopf editor-in-chief Sonny Mehta snapped up the American rights.
What I liked about it was the absolute ambition of it. It's so many things. It's a multi-generational family saga. It's a story of corporate corruption, of religious fanaticism. It's about the darker elements in contemporary society. And then at its basic level, it's a kind of a classic locked room mystery.
With the American rights secure, Knopf had to figure out how to market Larsson to American readers. Publicity director Paul Bogarts began by romancing booksellers months before publication with a flood of advanced reading copies of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
The retail channel was key because, of course, we're publishing a Swedish author who happens to be dead, okay? And, you know, in the absence of bookseller enthusiasm, you might, as a publisher, have a problem.
The goal, Bogard says, was to build momentum in the form of advanced book sales. Knopf also took out a late-summer ad in the New York Times Book Review, offering a free copy of the thriller to anyone who wrote asking for one. American bloggers read raves about Stieg Larsson by their European counterparts, finagled copies of his books from overseas, and began touting The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo early this year. American crime fiction columnist Sarah Weinman was an early champion on her blog Confessions of an Idiosyncratic Mind.
What makes any crime novel work, regardless of where it's set and what it's about, is how much empathy does the writer have for his or her chosen subjects and for his characters. And if there's one thing that comes through besides passion, it's also empathy.
Stieg Larsson's day job was as a crusading anti-fascist journalist who was passionate in his support of anyone being victimized. He co-founded a magazine in Sweden called Expo, where Daniel Poole was a colleague.
He is one of the few idealistic people. I've never met anyone like him, actually, to be honest. I read the books after he died. That was, in some way, a way to hear Stieg's voice again.
The American edition of the novel sports enthusiastic blurbs from such best-selling authors as Michael Connelly, Lee Child, and Harlan Coben, but also one from Michael Ondaatje, who wrote The English Patient.
Michael Ondaatje was in the office some months ago and saw it lying around, took a copy with him to a holiday in Hawaii or something, and then phoned me and said, "Who is this guy? What an absolutely wonderful read."
So how successful was Knopf at marketing The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? It debuted at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list. The second novel in the series is set to come out in the U.S. next fall. For NPR News, I'm Martha Woodruff.
A single flower from a mysterious sender is how the novel begins, and there's an excerpt at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro.
Now, a novel that tells the story of a ship. A tiny floating universe within itself, peopled with a vast disparity of characters. Well, if you can imagine that, our reviewer Alan Chews has the novel for you. It's called Sea of Poppies by Amitav Ghosh.
Amitav Ghosh conjures up a former slave ship called the Ibis in the year 1838. The ship is packed with a multitude of characters, a mixed-race novice seahand from Baltimore named Zachary Reed, and a mob of indentured Indian peasants, including a woman named Diti and her giant of a paramour, Kalua, both important to the plot, figures high and low, such as a Raja in debt to a British businessman and a Chinese criminal, farmers and soldiers, Malay crewmen, and a female French stowaway. They're all sailing to the island of Mauritius on a voyage that somehow plays a role in the British War to open up China to the opium trade. Ghosh tells the story of how all these characters, Indians and crew alike, end up on this voyage in an appealing, somewhat modified lingo of the period, when British English mingled with Indian Englishes and dallied with dozens of other dialects, ship's lore, pirate talk, Lascar pigeon, and all the other verbal music of the Indian Ocean and Arabian Sea. And beneath it all, like the endless rolling salt sea, Ghosh's own beautifully made sentences and paragraphs buoy up ship, plot, characters, and the setting itself with a natural ease and beauty. As in this passage, pun intended, when the ship, with its indentured passengers, most of whom have never seen the ocean, anchors for one last night in Indian waters. The last place, Ghosh writes, from which the migrants would be able to view their native shore. This was Sagar Roads, a much-trafficked anchorage in the lee of Ganga Sagar, the island that stands between the sea and the holy river. The very name, Ganga Sagar, served to remind the migrants of the yawning chasm ahead. It was as if they were sitting balanced on the edge of a precipice, and the island were an outstretched limb of sacred Jambudvipa, their homeland, reaching out to keep them from tumbling into the void. Reading this novel over a number of days, it takes its time, and so it takes your time, but only in the best of ways, I came to understand that all the good books do that, don't they? They help us to keep from tumbling into the void.
The novel Sea of Poppies is by Amitav Ghosh. Our reviewer is Alan Chews.
If you like to curl up under the covers and pull out a good book late at night, this next story is for you. As part of our three-book series, where writers suggest books on one theme, Will Lehman says there's an alternate reality after midnight, especially in the fantastical pages of these three books.
Daylight saving time has lapsed, and winter is creeping our way. Darkness comes sooner and lasts longer with every passing day. I know, I ought to go to bed earlier. But I'm still awake, hunkered in the midnight shadows with my nose in a book, letting my head run wild. In the first book, Haruki Murakami's After Dark, the cloak of night moves the world with a different logic. There are two sisters. Eri chooses not to wake for months, watched in her sleep by a mysterious camera. Mari stays awake in a downtown Tokyo Denny's drenched with Burt Bacharach and fluorescence. Murakami's dreamscape is neon lit, and it invites his characters to understand the interconnected drift of their lives. None of our principles have any effect here. No one can predict when or where such abysses will swallow people, or when or where they will spit them out. The title tale from Dashiell Hammett's short story collection, Nightmare Town, is also drenched in mystery. The hero buzzes into the frontier town of Izzard, drunk and on a bet. Over two long nights, the town ensnares the reader in a web of coincidence, deceit, and violence. The night is filled with asthmatic clocks, black streets, and a girl with violet black eyes. Hammett's prose sizzles with suspicion. Everything is a scam, a setup, and the rules are rigged against the main character as he tries to understand why everyone in the town is rife with deceit. It's an insomniac's tale if ever there was one. The characters barely sleep, and you won't be able to either. Finally, my third late-night read is Salman Rushdie's antic history of modern India, Midnight's Children. This novel insists that the dead of night suspends normal rules of existence. The narrator, Salim Sanai, is big-nosed and brilliant, whispering in your ear with a combination of mad humor and phantasmagoria. He was born in Bombay on the stroke of midnight on India's Independence Day when the clock hands joined palms in respectful greeting. As a result, Sanai is granted the miraculous power of telepathy. 1,000 other Midnight's children have powers more paranormal. The greater magic, however, is Rushdie's, a literary suspension of the rules that allows him to preach and prank using 1001 Arabian Nights and Superman at the same time. And he does it in a hybrid language that runs from the classical to the profane. It's not a nightmare as much as a fever dream. It will keep you till dawn on its explosive mix of fantasy and bitter history. These three books will make it hard for you to resist pulling up the covers for a good midnight read. Sure, morning brings exhaustion, but if you can't sleep, it's a joy to glimpse a world where sleeping seems a dull alternative to imagination.
Will Lehman is a writer, teacher, and musician. The three books he recommends are Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, Nightmare Town by Dashiell Hammett, and After Dark by Haruki Murakami. You can comment on this essay and find more Three Books recommendations at npr.org.
I am Netta Ulibi. This week on NPR's podcast Book Tour, we'll hear author Hooman Maj. His new book is called The Ayatollah Begs to Differ. It's intended to give Americans a new perspective on Iran.
Jawanfek sat down beside me on an ugly leatherette couch. He was dressed in navy blue trousers, a white shirt, and a navy cardigan. And with a soft voice and quiet, gentle demeanor, he appeared more as a college professor than a top aide to someone who has been likened to, at least in some of the Western media, Hitler.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other leading authors of fiction and nonfiction, visit npr.org/booktour.
Fast cars, beautiful women, and a vodka martini shaken, not stirred. In 7 James Bond movies, Roger Moore played the dashing, tuxedoed British agent 007 who saves the world, gets the girl, and looks fabulous doing it. In his new memoir, Roger Moore writes about his life, from a young boy growing up in London during World War II to how he landed the title role of Simon Templar in The Saint, a role that paved the way for his being cast as James Bond when Sean Connery retired. Roger Moore joins us now. If you want to talk with him about his life or his acting career as The Saint, as Bond, that's James Bond, give us a call. 800-989-8255. The email is talk@npr.org. Roger Moore is at our New York Bureau. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrea.
We're going to hear a lot of stories this hour about your days as James Bond, but I'd like to go back a little bit to ask you about the role of Simon Templar in the TV show The Saint. When you accepted that part, you thought it would only be one season, maybe two. You had no idea how successful it would become.
I even thought it was only going to be a half-hour series, and the contract actually was drawn up, what I thought, for 39 half hours, was for 39 hours, and it wasn't until Lou Grade, who was the head of ATV and ITC, was making the press announcement and saying, and we're going to do 39 hours, and I said half hours, and the two producers of the show at that time dragged me to one side and said, it's an hour, and I said, well, I must say I read the script and thought it was awfully long for half an hour. But there we are. The agent who drew up that contract was not my agent for very long.
I see. You write in your book, though, and we should say the title of the book is My Word is My Bond, a memoir. You write in your book that those were very happy days for you on The Saint.
Actually, all my days working have been very happy. I just like working. I love the atmosphere of being in a studio or in the theatre. I like being with other actors, and I like being with technicians.
And you write that after Sean Connery left the Bond series, you were on the short list, but the part went to George Lazenby?
They'd actually asked after about the fourth, or the fifth, when Sean was getting anxious to make a move, and I'd been approached, and there was a script being prepared, and locations had been searched out in Cambodia, and then all hell broke loose in Cambodia and the film was shelved. And by that time I'd moved on to other things, so George Lazenby came in, did one, and Sean came back, and then Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli approached me.
Let's listen to this scene from The Spy Who Loved Me. You've just met beautiful Russian agent Triple X, played by Barbara Bach.
The lady will have a Bacardi on the rocks.
For the gentleman, vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
Touché.
Commander James Bond, recruited to the British Secret Service from the Royal Navy. Licensed to kill, and has done so on numerous occasions. Many lady friends, but married only once. Wife killed.
All right, you've made your point.
You're sensitive, Mr. Bond.
About certain things, yes.
Sir Roger Moore, you say that is your favorite Bond movie of the seven you made. Why is that your favorite?
Well, the director, Lewis Gilbert, was the first film I'd made with him, and he was such a funny man. Identical sense of humor to mine, completely off the wall, mad as a hatter. We just had so many laughs making the film. We also had wonderful occasions. We spent the first month shooting in rehearsing in Sardinia. I was learning to ride a wet bike, a jet bike that had never been seen on the screen before. And I managed to get paid just to sit in the sun and eat pasta and drink Italian wine. It's not bad.
Not a bad life, it sounds like there. The first film you made, though, of the Bond series was Live and Let Die, an apt title. You had a serious accident during the shooting that sent you to the hospital. What happened?
You always have accidents on Bond films. So, we were rehearsing practicing driving a jet boat. Now, a jet boat, you know, it does 40, 50 miles an hour, 55 or something, and its steering is completely controlled by the power. So if you put over to the left, the power, you'll make a sharp left turn. And the more power you put on, the shorter and quicker the turn. The trouble is, once the power goes, the boat will remain going in the direction you were going when the engine cut out, which is what happened. And somebody had inconvenient left a boathouse on the edge of the bayou that I was supposed to be negotiating, and I went straight into it.
Oh, my goodness.
It was actually lucky that it happened during that sequence, because for the first 10 days, I was hobbling around on a stick. But as we were shooting in a boat, I would just hobbled into the boat and sat down.
This question about Live and Let Die from Clayton in Palo Alto, California. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, like, what was your favorite part of shooting Live and Let Die? Because there's a lot of really cool boat chases.
Well, thank you, Clayton. The boat chases were great fun to do, apart from the time that I smashed my teeth and my knee. But I had a lot of laughs, and particularly I had some very good friends in it. David Hedison, who played Felix Leiter, and Clifton James, who... there were some great characters around in that film.
That's great. And I understand that you, in the love scenes, of course, there were many of them, the love scenes with Jane Seymour, who played Solitaire in the movie, you both had your socks on back there?
Well, when you've been filming in Jamaica in sort of 120 degrees of no shade, and you come back to a cold English stage in the middle of the winter, and the doors have been open on the stage, and then you have to climb into... cold bed, no electric blankets, no hot water bottle, just the two of you freezing to death underneath a sheet, trying to look cool. You needed something on your feet to keep them warm.
Somehow I don't understand the glamour of James Bond with his socks on in bed. But let's go to David in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, David.
Hi, Mr. Moore. Sam Moore, it is a really, really pleasure to talk to you.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I'm saying it's a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I grew up in Kenya, in Africa, and I've been a lover of the James Bond movies. But I particularly remember when I was 12 years old, I remember going to the store. My mother had sent me to the store. But I saw that the Bond movie, For Your Eyes Only, was showing that day. And I decided, instead of buying whatever my mother had sent me, I would walk in and just watch the movie. And when I went back home, I had to explain where the money went to. And I had probably the worst whooping my father ever gave me for all my life. But to this day, I still don't regret it. You know, it's one of the...
Well, I'm very sorry you got a whopping for that. I was actually, I was in Kenya about 3 months ago in Nairobi and then the Masai Mara. But in Nairobi, I was visiting some UNICEF projects and also a wonderful place for home for abandoned babies run by the Feed the Children organization in America. I found that part of the trip very, very interesting. The rest, Masai Mara, you know, fascinating with the hippos and the lion and the tiger and the ostriches. Yeah, I had a good time.
Roger Moore, it's so much fun to hear that people all over the world know your work. I wonder what it's like to have had a career with a breadth. You did lots of things, but to be defined by these 7 movies you made. I mean, you are James Bond everywhere you go.
Well, I'm James Bond, except for the people that haven't seen a Bond film before, and the first film they see is with Daniel Craig, and he is going to be the definitive Bond. There are many, many, many people just a little older than I am who there can't be many of those around, I tell you.
But
for them, Sean Connery was the definitive Bond. And then there's a whole generation that grew up with Timothy Dalton and with Pierce Brosnan. So to be known for something as successful as that after so many years is very gratifying. I'm very happy about it.
Let's take a quick question from Scott in Cazenovia, New York. Scott?
That's right, Cazenovia, New York. Sir Roger, it's just a pleasure to talk with you, and allow me to say that for 35 years, since the very early 70s, my family... My parents, my brother and I, take us very early age to go see the James Bond movies, and we've gone to see every James Bond movie in the theaters. It's always a family event, and I have to say that you and Sean Connery have defined what it is for who James Bond is. And I will always compare all the future James Bonds to Sir Roger Moore and Sean Connery. And we're going to go see, in carrying the tradition this Friday, we're going to see the new one that's out. And I can't wait to tell my mom, my dad, and my brother and new family that I got to say that to Sir Roger Moore today. So thank you. You've done a wonderful job portraying James Bond and helped define who he is in our minds.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. That's very kind of you. Somebody yesterday in a radio interview said they compared going to a Bond to be a father and son bonding, and that a boy really came of age when his father said to him, "Come on, son, I'll take you to see a Bond movie." It never occurred to me before, but it sounds like a very good selling point for my book.
Curtis,
you know, bond with Bond, and buy your son or buy your dad Bond's book.
My guest is Sir Roger Moore. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Curtis in Oklahoma City. You have a family tradition as well?
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, Sir Roger, the first one of yours that I remember fully seeing all the way through as a kid was your first one, Live and Let Die. And I've always been a big fan of that one.
Thank you.
I had a question. I don't know if this story is true or apocryphal, but I remember reading years ago that your son was asking you if you were tougher than James Bond. And when you said, "Well, I am James Bond," he goes, "No, the real James Bond, Sean Connery."
Yep, that's true. It was
hurt.
My son was 8 years old. I took him to lunch at the White Elephant in London, and he sat there, he looked around the room, and he said, "Dad, could you beat up anybody in here?" And I looked around, they're all fairly old. I said, "Yeah, sure I could." He said, "What about if James Bond came in?" I said, "But I'm going to be James Bond." He said, "No, I mean the real one, Sean Connery." Now, that son of mine has never grown beyond 3'6". I don't know why. No, he's a nice boy.
I see. How about this call from Ted in Boise, Idaho? Ted, go ahead.
Hi, Sir Roger. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I had a question. I wanted to know if you and Sean Connery and George Lazenby and all the other men who played James Bond ever got together to discuss James Bond and who he was and, yeah, you know, that sort of thing.
It's a small club, but a good one, huh? You guys get together?
No, I see Sean from time to time when he's in London. He lives in the Bahamas. I speak to George Lazenby. In fact, I saw him a few months ago. He's a hell of a nice guy. And Timothy Dalton I see when I'm in California. Pierce I haven't seen for a while. And Daniel Craig I actually met for the first time a month ago. We were at the London Palladium celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ian Fleming. And that was the first time I met Daniel Craig, and we were sharing a dressing room. And he is one hell of a nice guy.
What do you think of his movies?
I saw Casino Royale. Mm-hmm. I had to buy the DVD. They didn't give me a discount. But I'm only joking. I thought he was absolutely terrific, and I would have been dead after the first 5 minutes of shooting a film with that magnitude of gymnastics that he went through. He's jumping, he's running. I thought he was terrific.
I've read, and we've gotten some emails from listeners, this one from Nathan in Salem, Oregon, that you are disappointed in the turn the Bond series has taken of late, due presumably to Bond's increasingly violent style?
No, this has been sort of a misquote. I was asked by a journalist the other day, was it true that I'd been upset by the violence of such and such a film, which was my last Bond, which was A View to a Kill? And I had got rather lazy and not seen all the dailies, you know, the work we did the day before. And so I missed some of the stuff where there were sort of machine guns and people falling down dead and blood all over the place. And so when I saw the first rough assembly of the film, I was rather shocked that it had taken that turn for violence. But I don't think I'm disturbed by the violence of Casino Royale or what would probably, from what I've seen of Quantum Solace. No, I think that it's with the times. You know, it's born identity time with movies. And this is what people are looking for, the nitty-gritty and realistic approach, and I'm sure it's the right one. And I was just looking now at the Hollywood Reporter and looking at the figures from the first weekend opening outside America, mm-hmm. where I think they've notched up $180 million. So I think people around the world are accepting it and liking it.
Have you seen? You haven't seen Quantum of Solace yet?
No. Unfortunately, we'd just gone to Paris when it opened in London. My book was being released in Paris, where it's not called My Word Is My Bond. It has to be called Amicalement Votre, which was the title of the series I did, The Persuaders, with Tony Curtis.
Ah, I see. Another clever name there. Sir Roger Moore, he joined us from our bureau in New York. His memoir is called My Word Is Bond. And let me say, if I may be so bold, you sound just as dashing now as you ever did, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you very much.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.